use of the deal to run advertisements in districts and states to pressure members of Congress. The Iranians thought we would cave on the remaining issues to avoid the longer congressional period, but Obama wanted to show that we were willing to live without a deal. Day after day, on little to no sleep, Kerry and Moniz haggled over the remaining issues. On July 12th, the pieces started coming together. On the 13th, Susan and I went into the Oval Office for Obama's final call with Kerry. The deal was basically done, but Obama needed to give his approval. We watched as Obama listened on the phone. "John, you should be very proud," he said. With that, he hung up the phone and smiled. "Looks like we have a deal." "That took 8 years," I said. "We should call that YouTube guy," he said, referring to the 2007 debate question about engaging adversaries. Obama turned to the statement he'd give the next morning. "Make sure we frame this as a nuclear issue," he told me. Ever since Netanyahu's speech to Congress, critics had been using Iran's non-nuclear behavior, its support for terrorism, its belligerence in the Middle East, to delegitimize the deal. "We don't want to let the critics muddy the nuclear issue with other issues." A few days before the deal was finalized, I sat at my desk reading a story in my press clips. "This is insane," I said. Ned Price, a former CIA analyst who had recently become the NSC spokesperson sitting right outside my office, came in and asked what I was talking about. "Check out this Breitbart story," I said. Ned read the beginning of the story over my shoulder. "Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes, who lacks any prior qualifications for the post, has explained to The Atlantic's Jeffrey Goldberg at the Aspen Ideas Festival on Monday that the administration believes that a bad Iran deal is worth doing because political reform inside the Iranian regime is more likely with the deal than without. Or, to use Rhodes' own words, we believe that the kiss of the nuke deal will turn the Iranian frog into a handsome prince." "That's insane," Ned said. Unlike my doctored Benghazi email, this didn't sound anything like something that I, or any human being, would say. We checked the transcript. As it turned out, this is what I had actually said. "We believe that an agreement is necessary and has to be good enough to be worth doing, even if Iran doesn't change. If 10 or 15 years from now, Iran is the same as it is today in terms of its government, the deal has to be good enough that it can exist on those merits." This was central to our whole argument. We needed a deal to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon precisely because it was a bad actor. That, of course, is why critics were trying to turn the argument inside out. I reached out to Goldberg, who publicly disputed the story, but fact checks weren't going to reach the readers of Breitbart, which had already published more than one story, spawning an unknowable number of follow-on internet stories, talk radio segments, and tweets. "We believe that the kiss of the nuke deal will turn the Iranian frog into a handsome prince." Millions of people would consume this information in a matter of hours, far more than the readership of the New York Times. It was fake news, and there was no way to dissuade people who chose to believe things that validated their established convictions. Breitbart had already run a story about an NSC staffer on Iran named Sahar Norozada because she was Iranian-American and once interned for an organization that advocated for diplomacy with Iran. Sahar was a career civil servant for a decade, starting out in George W. Bush's Pentagon. The stories made her out to be a Manchurian candidate, advocating for Iran's interests within the Obama White House. Afterward, Obama invited her into the Oval Office. "Don't let them get you down," he said, posing for a picture with her in front of his desk. She kept a huge smile frozen on her face, fighting off tears. Later, in my office, I gave her my own pep talk. "We just can't let them win." It was the type of thing I had been telling myself for years, and I knew it was cold comfort, enough to motivate you through the day, but not to make the nature of our opposition any less disconcerting. Dozens of people, diplomats, lawyers, sanctions experts, nuclear scientists, intelligence analysts, had worked on Wendy Sherman's team for years to get the Iran deal done. I felt as though they had handed off a baton to me and my team, and we had 60 days to make sure Congress wouldn't undo their work. There was no doubt we'd confront a well-financed and relentless effort to undermine the deal. The last time we raised concerns before an actual vote on a piece of Iran sanctions legislation, a 2011 sanctions bill strongly supported by AIPAC, it ended up passing 100-0 in the Senate. I sat at the table in my apartment, reviewing different pieces of a plan of congressional briefings and public outreach that would carry us through the next 2 months. "I've never been this stressed before," I said to Anne, who was in the kitchen. "What do you mean?" she asked. "I feel like this is all on me." "That's crazy," she said. "There are lots of people in this." She started ticking off the State Department's leadership. "Kerry, Wendy, Tony. It's not the same," I said. "Why?" she asked. "This is what John Kerry has worked for his whole life." "It just isn't the same," I said. I took a deep breath and stared at the computer screen. "I can't explain. Kerry, at least, was also able to focus on diplomacy. I was about to spend 2 months down in the muck, doing the part of my job that I enjoyed the least, and it felt like the most important thing I was ever going to do." The next morning, I pitched Dennis McDonough on my concept. I wanted to take the Iran team I'd already built and turn it into a standing working group of people who would focus entirely on securing congressional support for the deal. "You still have a job," he said. "You'll need someone else to run the war room." I turned to a guy named Chad Kreichmeier, an amiable Nebraskan and former Hill staffer who worked on legislative affairs at the White House. Together, we'd put together a collection of combative personalities and eccentric experts who would cover policy, communications, digital outreach, engagement with the Jewish community, liaison with progressive organizations, and, above all, constant communication with members of Congress and their offices. I made the offer, and Chad said he'd think about it. Unspoken was the fact that whoever took on a prominent role defending the Iran deal was going to put a target on his own back. Less than an hour after leaving my office, he came back. "Okay," he said. "There's no way I'm not doing this." "Congratulations," I said. "I think. You just took command of the war room." We ended up calling it the anti-war room. Obama charged us with making sure we mobilized the constellation of progressive groups who had joined together during the Bush administration to oppose the Iraq War. "Democrats are going to be feeling a lot of pressure from the AIPAC folks," he said. "We need to make sure they hear from folks on the other side, especially over August recess." Our case was straightforward. The deal prevented Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. The Iranians had to remove 2/3 of their centrifuges, couldn't use their more advanced centrifuges, and had to get rid of 98% of their stockpile. They had to convert a heavy water reactor so it couldn't produce plutonium. Inspectors would have 24/7 access to Iran's nuclear facilities and the ability to access Iran's entire nuclear supply chain, from uranium mines and mills to centrifuge manufacturing and storage facilities. To cheat, Iran wouldn't just need a nuclear facility like Natanz or Fordo. They'd have to run an entirely secret supply chain. If they cheated, sanctions would snap back into place. Then there were the consequences of not having the deal. Without it, Iran could quickly advance its nuclear program to the point of having enough material for a bomb. That would leave us with a choice between bombing their facilities and acquiescing to a nuclear-armed Iran. Holding out for a better deal was not going to work. It was diplomacy or war. The press reported that AIPAC and other opposition groups were planning to spend up to $40 million on advertisements and other efforts to kill the deal, which would intimidate members of Congress, several of whom called me to express concerns that we had no similar resources to spend. They sent out long anti-Iran deal documents that would shape the arguments we'd hear made back at us from deal opponents on the Hill or in the media. Every morning, we'd convene the 20 or so people who comprised our anti-war room to map out what arguments needed to be countered, what Hill meetings needed to be scheduled, what briefings had to take place, of scientists, experts, journalists, or advocates. Matt Nozenchuk, the permanently smiling man in charge of our Jewish outreach, asked what his objective should be. "I want you to talk to every Jewish person in America," I said. "Every Jew in America," he repeated. "Okay." Chad set up an office in a closet-sized room in the basement of the West Wing, where he listed every Democratic senator on a whiteboard to track where they were on the issue and what needed to be done to win their vote. Every question that was raised about the deal would be fact-checked, both publicly and in materials sent to Congress. To make sure that people would see our fact-checks in real time, we set up a Twitter account, @TheIranDeal. If the opposition's advantage was the fact that the Israeli government and AIPAC were focused on lawmakers who dreaded taking a position against them, our advantage was the fact that we needed only Democratic votes. When Scott Walker, a Republican presidential candidate, said he might take military action against Iran on the first day of his presidency, we made sure that got around to Democratic offices. When Scooter Libby, an intellectual architect of the Iraq War, wrote an op-ed attacking the deal, we pointed out that the same people who got us into Iraq wanted to take us to war in Iran. "Wrong then, wrong now," became our mantra. Obama made a point of being the chief salesman himself. He had the entire Democratic caucus to the White House. He did interviews and made speeches. Toward the end of July, he went on The Daily Show to reach the younger audience that we'd need to buck up Democrats. "If people are engaged, eventually the political system responds," Obama said. "Despite the money, despite the lobbyists, it still responds." Later, on a conference call with anti-war activists, he noted that the same people who supported the Iraq War were now opposing the Iran deal. That's when things began to take an ugly turn. These were anodyne and accurate statements. Yet some deal opponents started to make a new charge, that Obama and his team were anti-Semites, conjuring up stereotypes of moneyed Jewish interests propelling us into a war. This put us into an impossible position. Even to acknowledge the fact that AIPAC was spending tens of millions to defeat the Iran deal was anti-Semitic. To observe that the same people who supported the war in Iraq also opposed the Iran deal was similarly off-limits. It was an offensive way for people to avoid accountability for their own positions. Obama wasn't going to be intimidated. In a short meeting with a group of us before he spoke to American Jewish community leaders in early August, I explained that people were accusing him of using anti-Semitic dog whistles. "Dog whistles?" he asked. "How exactly?" "By saying that the same people who got us into the war in Iraq want to take us to war with Iran." "How is that a dog whistle?" He was incredulous and, as was often the case when I was the messenger for this type of thing, he talked to me as if I was the one making the criticism. "They're saying that's us calling Jews warmongers." "Oh, come on," he said. "John Bolton wants to bomb Iran, right?" "Yes," I said. Bolton had written an op-ed for the New York Times entitled, "To Stop Iran's Bomb, Bomb Iran." "Is he Jewish?" "No." "Dick Cheney?" "No." "I'm black," he said. "I think I know when folks are using dog whistles. I hear them all the time." His voice was raised a bit, which almost never happened. "Come on." He paused, returning to his even temperament. "This is aggravating." "I know," I said. "I'm the self-hating Jew, or half-self-hating." He laughed, then turned more serious. "This isn't about anti-Semitism," he said. "They're trying to take away our best argument, that it's this or war." Before going on his own August vacation, he gave a speech at American University. In it, he made a case for the deal that he wanted Democrats to take home with them over recess. "I know it's easy to play on people's fears, to magnify threats, to to compare any attempt at diplomacy to Munich. But none of these arguments hold up, he said. They didn't back in 2002, in 2003. They shouldn't now. That same mindset, in many cases offered by the same people who seem to have no compunction about being repeatedly wrong, led to a war that did more to strengthen Iran or to isolate the United States than anything we have done in the decades before or since. The reaction was fierce. In one of the harsher responses, an editorial in Tablet magazine lamented, "The use of anti-Jewish incitement as a political tool is a sickening new development in American political discourse, and we have heard too much of it lately, some coming ominously from our own White House and its representatives." I cringed when I read these things. Support for Israel had been central to my own sense of identity as I was coming of age, a way for a child of mixed religious background to find an anchor in culture and history. Now that kind of attachment was being cynically manipulated to discredit a profoundly unbiased president, destroy a diplomatic agreement, and once again, avoid any reckoning with the actual legacy of Iraq. I spent my August vacation calling senators and comparing vote counts with Dick Durbin, who was leading the effort in the Senate and reporting every shred of gossip to Obama. Unlike the previous year, Obama relished working in Martha's Vineyard, calling more than 30 members of Congress from his vacation home. After each call, he'd send me a note about something we could do to help a Democrat get to yes. A letter from him, a surrogate in their district, a particular argument that needed to be made. Gradually, things started to break our way. People other than us started to shoot down the anti-Semitism charge. 29 leading physicists came out for the deal. European ambassadors lobbied on behalf of the agreement. Retired national security officials and ambassadors to Israel wrote letters of support. Dozens of retired Israeli generals signed a petition contradicting Netanyahu and supporting the deal. So did the former head of Mossad. 340 rabbis wrote an open letter. Several dozen Iranian dissidents signed a letter indicating that supporters of human rights in Iran supported the deal. A majority of American Jews supported the deal in public opinion surveys, a higher percentage than in the broader public. A steady drumbeat of Democrats started to come out in support. As Congress came back to town, it was clear we'd have enough support in the House and Senate to uphold a presidential veto if Congress voted to reject the deal. Our efforts narrowed to a handful of Democratic senators who could get us to the 41 votes necessary to prevent Congress from even passing a rejection of the deal. We also wanted to secure a healthy majority of Jewish Democrats in the House so the deal would be less polarizing. The key vote remained Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the congresswoman from Florida and head of the Democratic National Committee, whom I had spent many hours talking to about Iran over the years. I was up in New York City when she called and said she needed to speak to Obama. Around the same time, a reporter emailed me to say he'd heard Debbie was coming out against the deal. All day I was in a bad mood, worried that the head of the DNC was announcing her opposition. Obama couldn't call her until late at night, and so it was midnight when I got a note that they'd connected. When Debbie finally called me, my mother was speaking in Yiddish in the background, saying she'd go down to Debbie's district to give a piece of her mind to any of the Meshuggahs who gave her grief. Debbie told me she was a yes, and we both ended up in tears. "Tell your mother she's welcome down here any time," she said. By the time Congress voted on the deal, we had logged more than 1,200 engagements with members of Congress. For many of them, the decision was wrenching, politically and personally. But in the end, nearly all of the final votes broke our way. 42 senators supported the deal, ensuring that Congress would not be able to express disapproval. On the day that we secured our final votes, Dick Cheney gave a speech at the American Enterprise Institute, the heart of neoconservatism, which he'd scheduled before our success was a foregone conclusion. We watched gleefully from the anti-war room as Cheney reinforced our contention that the same people who got us into war in Iraq wanted to do the same thing in Iran. One moment in particular seemed to encapsulate all that had happened over 2 months. Anti-war protesters disrupted the speech, shouting, "He was wrong on Iraq, he is wrong on Iran," which prompted an older white guy to get up and try to rip a sign from a young woman's hand. After a few awkward moments, he gave up and fell back into his chair. I took Chad up to the Oval Office. Obama smiled. "That was actually kind of fun," he told us. "I'll never do anything like that again in government," Chad said. Chapter 27. Bombs and Children. About 15 of us boarded a weathered, canopied motorboat from Luang Prabang, the ancient Buddhist capital of Laos, for a 90-minute ride up the Mekong River. The water was brown and slow-moving, and as the wooden hotels and temples faded in the distance, the riverbank became overwhelmed by thick, green forest at the base of rolling hills. The boat was filled with embassy staff and some local Lao contacts who chatted leisurely and kept a slight distance from me. I had the sense that they were all trying to figure out what I was doing there. We arrived at a beach where several dozen young children were assembled under a tarp tied to some wooden poles, singing songs. Our boat was full of school supplies. The kids were arranged into rows for some kind of performance, while I stood in front of them next to our ambassador, Dan Clune. I noticed a particularly sassy girl of about 5 in the front row, wearing an oversized T-shirt decorated with a huge picture of Elsa from Frozen. After the kids danced and sang a couple of songs, Dan, my assistant, Rumana Ahmed, and I climbed into a Toyota Land Cruiser with a large stamp on it stamped, "From the Government of Japan," for a short drive to a clearance site for unexploded ordnance. "They'll give you a briefing," Dan said, "and then there will be a demonstration." Laos is the most heavily bombed country in the history of the world. From 1964 to 1973, the United States dropped more than 2 million tons of ordnance on Laos to disrupt the Ho Chi Minh Trail and try to stanch a communist insurgency, more than was dropped on all of Germany and Japan during World War II. There were 580,000 bombing missions, which averages out to one every 8 minutes for 9 years. Sometimes, U.S. planes returning to Thailand from missions over Vietnam indiscriminately dropped their remaining bombs on Laos. More than 270 million cluster munitions, bombies, were used, and 80 million of them failed to detonate. In the 4 decades since the end of the war, only 1% have been cleared. More than 50,000 people have been killed or injured in UXO accidents. Over the last decade, nearly half of those casualties have been children. We stopped and got out of the Land Cruiser. A white tent was set up on a hill overlooking a field where a team of women wearing khaki uniforms had been searching for bombies with rudimentary metal detectors in the tall grass of a rice paddy. Under the tent, a briefing space was set up where a group of men huddled around U.S. military maps from the war that showed the location of bombing runs. This was an eclectic group of briefers, a man from UXO Lao, the agency responsible for clearance efforts, a Laotian in a drab military uniform who looked old enough to have fought in the war, an excited French contractor, a farmer who had found the ordnance in the adjacent field. He smiled when they gestured to him, showing only a couple of teeth. "With additional resources," said the man from UXO Lao, "we can conduct a survey of the whole country. Then we can clear areas needed for farming. UXO is not just a humanitarian issue. For us, it's also development." The man paused, measuring my reaction. Everyone seemed a bit on edge, as if I represented their best shot at securing an infusion of funding. There was no mention of the fact that I represented the government that had dropped hundreds of millions of cluster munitions on this country for no reason that could possibly be rationalized. "This is actually one of the most heavily bombed areas," he said to me, gesturing at the hills in the distance. The Plain of Jars. We crossed over the field to where a woman with a smiling face showed me how the metal detectors work, leading me over to where they'd found a bomby earlier that day. We stood in a circle around it, looking down. It resembled a metallic baseball. "The children, they see it," said the head of UXO Lao. "They think it's a toy and pick it up, and then..." He broke off into the sound of an explosion. We moved back across the field. They had tied a long wire to this bomby and attached it to an orange device under our tent. I thought of the time and effort that went into finding and exploding this single bomby, with 80 million still buried out there in the vast country. They asked me to turn a handle several times to blow it up. I expected something akin to a large firecracker. Instead, an enormous blast shook the ground underneath my feet, echoing across the river valley, sending a towering plume of smoke into the air. It was possible, in that moment, to envision the river valley filled with explosions, smoke covering the Mekong, plains overhead. In one of my meetings with the Lao government that day, I had pressed for more cooperation in identifying the remains of American servicemen who'd gone missing in Laos. To date, we had found the remains of 273 Americans. Extraordinary efforts were put into finding even the most minimal traces of life. A tooth, for instance. It was hard to square the extent to which we admirably valued every American life with the bombs that we'd dropped. The briefing team stood waiting for me to say something. "Every morning," I had said, "I meet with President Obama. We want to do everything that we can to help. When I get home, I will tell him about the work that you are doing here." Tears welled up in the eyes of one of the men, even though he was much more hardened by life than I am. We drove back to where the children were, less than a mile away. I stood at the front of a line, handing out books, pencils, and M&Ms that Rumana had brought in her luggage. Rumana, a Muslim American covered in a hijab, smiled and played with one of the girls, who shook the box of M&Ms, thinking it was a rattle. An embassy staffer next to me asked how the UXO demonstration had gone. "It was a much bigger explosion than I expected," I said. "Yeah," he said. "None of the kids even looked up." I know how this is going to sound, but Anthony Bourdain was the one who hooked me on Laos. Over the previous year, I had slipped further into insomnia, the accumulated effect of Benghazi stress and a hungry newborn keeping me awake for long stretches of each night. I'd fill that time lying on my couch in a darkened living room, plowing through every episode of Bourdain's various travel shows over and over. I felt a sense of recognition in this guy wandering around the world, trying to find some temporary connection with other human beings living within their own histories. I'd been vaguely familiar with the story of Laos. Hillary had visited in 2012, and I remembered that we cobbled together some money for UXO clearance, a few numbers on a budget sheet. But the Bourdain episode that showed human beings on a television screen in the middle of the night, struggling in a place that was still a war zone, 40 years after a war that I'd never learned about in school, woke my interest. I added two items to the bucket list for my final year in the job. Get more money for Laos, and get Obama to tape an episode of Parts Unknown with Anthony Bourdain. Obama was scheduled to visit Laos in the fall of 2016 for a summit, so I had resolved to go myself a year in advance, to create the basis to come back to Washington and find more money to clean up bombs. Now, here I was, in a hotel in Luang Prabang, having just seen one of those bombs with my own eyes. I lay in bed, replaying the day's events in my head. We'd boarded the boat for the ride back to the city, heading back down the river as the light drew down to near complete darkness, and I'd thought about what it'd be like to leave the world behind to run some small hotel on the riverbank, catering to backpackers and European tourists. At dinner that night with Dan Clune, I had talked about how the longer I served in government, the more war of any kind made less sense to me, rife as it was with unintended consequences. We were in our 15th year of war in Afghanistan, and it was hard to see what positive difference we were making. A rounding error of the money we spent each year in Afghanistan could alter the trajectory of a country like Laos, feeding children, sending them to school, cleaning up the bombs that they stumbled upon. As I finally started to drift to sleep, a loud group of people returned to the hotel room next to me, laughing drunkenly and playing music. I gave up on sleep and my efforts to shut down my thoughts. My mind ran over the 6 weeks that had passed since we secured the Iran deal. There had been the United Nations General Assembly in September, where Putin seized the spotlight by escalating Russia's military intervention in Syria and beginning to bomb Assad's opposition. As usual, the issue had been framed as a showdown between Putin and Obama. As usual, Obama's case depended upon a much longer view of history. Ultimately, he argued, the bill would come due for Putin's interventions, the money spent on wars abroad, the impact of sanctions on his economy, the rot of a corrupt system in which Putin and his cronies ran Russia as a cartel. But in the reality of politics in 2015, Putin was better than Obama at putting himself at the center of events that captured attention. We ended up looking as if we were reacting to Putin and not the other way around. I couldn't escape a gnawing sense of futility about our ability to change things in Syria. More civilians were being killed and displaced. Refugees were streaming into Europe. A brutal dictator, backed by brutal regimes in Iran and Russia, was winning the war, even if it was hard to see how what he was doing amounted to victory. At the same time, I couldn't summon the optimism I'd had in 2011 and 2012, the belief that America could make things better in the Middle East. It was far easier for me to see how the war in Syria was in part an unintended consequence of other American wars, no matter how well-meaning they might have been. The toppling of Saddam Hussein had strengthened Iran, provoked Putin, opened up a Pandora's box of sectarian conflict that now raged in Iraq and Syria, and led to an insurgency that had given birth to ISIL. The toppling of Muammar Gaddafi had made plain to dictators that you either cling to power or end up dead in a sewer. Syria looked more and more like a moral morass, a place where our inaction was a tragedy and our intervention would only compound the tragedy. Obama kept probing for options that could make a positive difference, finding none. It was approaching 2 a.m. and the party next door raged on. I reached up and banged on the wall. Muffled voices quieted. After a few minutes, I heard a door close as people left. I could imagine the staff were Johnson and Nixon, people who worked in the same offices that I spent my day in back in Washington. People just like me, with the same titles and similar pressures. One of the reasons we had bombed Laos was to preserve our credibility, to show that even if America was defeated in neighboring Vietnam, we would make the victory a costly one for our adversaries. In our post-9/11 chapter, I knew there would be no victory in Afghanistan or Iraq, or in any other new war that we might start in that part of the world. I thought of how Obama chafed at the argument that he needed to bomb Syria to preserve his own credibility. "That's the worst reason to go to war," he'd say. As I drifted to sleep, the quiet in the next room was interrupted as the couple remaining began to make love. Sleep was going to be hard to come by. A few weeks later, Obama slid into the back seat of the Beast after finishing a press conference at the conclusion of the G20 in Turkey. It was only a few days after a horrifying terrorist attack in Paris, which killed more than 100 people and sent waves of panic around the world. "Can you believe that?" he said. "Every one of them asked the same question." 129 people were killed in Paris on Friday night. ISIL claimed responsibility for that massacre, sending the message that they could now target civilians all over the world. The equation has clearly changed. Isn't it time for your strategy to change? A more than year-long bombing campaign in Iraq and in Syria has failed to contain the ambition and the ability of ISIL to launch attacks in the West. Have you underestimated their abilities? In the days and weeks before the Paris attacks, did you receive warning in your daily intelligence briefing that an attack was imminent? If not, does that not call into question the current assessment that there is no immediate, specific, credible threat to the United States? I think a lot of Americans have this frustration that they see that the United States has the greatest military in the world. It has the backing of nearly every other country in the world when it comes to taking on ISIS. I guess the question is, and if you'll forgive the language, is why can't we take out these bastards? Obama popped a piece of Nicorette into his mouth and took out his iPad. "Why don't you get the bastards?" he said, laughing ruefully. He looked at Susan. "Susan, why don't you get the bastards?" "I still think we should just put them in the terror dome," I said. For a few weeks, we'd fantasized about creating a kind of Hunger Games with ISIL, Al-Qaeda, and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, the Russian Special Forces in eastern Ukraine. We'd just gather up all of the world's most nihilistic forces and put them under one dome. "Put them in the terror dome," Obama said. He noticed that I was reading some of the initial coverage of the press conference on my BlackBerry. "What is it?" he asked. "Nothing," I said, knowing it would bother him. "No, what is it?" "Some people think you were most passionate in talking about refugees," I said. In his last answer, Obama had attacked some of the refugee proposals being made in the Republican primary, including one from Jeb Bush, to admit only Christians fleeing persecution. "When I hear political leaders suggesting that there would be a religious test for which a person who's fleeing from a war-torn country is admitted," Obama had said, "that's shameful. That's not American. That's not who we are. We don't have religious tests to our compassion." That statement was being held up as a sign that he was out of touch. "So?" he asked. "They're saying that you were angrier at the Republicans than at ISIL. What do I have to do to convince these people that I hate ISIL?" he asked. "I've called them a death cult. I've promised to destroy them. We're bombing them. We're arming people fighting them." His voice trailed off. It was silent for a few moments. "You know why I do that?" he said, returning to the criticism he'd leveled against Republicans. "Because it's my job to calm folks down, not to scare them. I expect it from Trump, but someone like Jeb Bush should know better. He does know better. And I've got Angela taking in hundreds of thousands of refugees. I've got to have her back. I can't leave her hanging." He looked down at his iPad, scanning the coverage. "Why don't you get the bastards?" he said again, shaking his head. On the flight to our next stop, Manila, Obama called Paul Ryan, who had just become Speaker of the House. There were proposals in Congress to ban refugees from coming to the United States, and Obama wanted to slow them down. He argued that we could put in place stricter vetting for people coming from certain countries, and that it'd be harder to get other countries to take in refugees if the United States didn't. I watched as he listened to Ryan's response, his face betraying growing annoyance. "Paul," he said. "Paul, I understand the problems you have in your caucus, but you're Speaker now. This isn't something to play politics with. This is about who we are as a country." A few moments later, he hung up and looked at us. "I'm going to miss Boehner," he said, and walked out of the room. Elizabeth Fu was the NSC staffer traveling with us, responsible for Southeast Asia. She was also a refugee. Her Vietnamese father had worked for the U.S. Army during the war. After America pulled out of South Vietnam, Phu was sent to a re-education camp for several months. She was 3 years old. Her grandparents sold all of their possessions to get them out and put Phu and her parents on a small boat with more than 250 people on it. When the boat's engines died, pirates seized it, demanding any possessions of value. Fu's father made a deal. In exchange for the wedding rings of those on board, the pirates would tow the boat to a nearby Malaysian island. Once ashore, Fu and her family waited in a refugee processing center. The last stop of our trip was Malaysia, and we were going to visit the Dignity for Children Foundation, where refugees similarly await permanent resettlement in other countries, including the United States. That morning, I invited Fu to ride with us in the Beast, and she told Obama about her journey, from being one of the boat people to an upbringing in California to working for the U.S. government. It made me proud to be American. When we pulled up at the refugee center, she sat next to Obama and had her picture taken. Inside, there was a group of small children seated at low, round tables in a classroom. Each of them had fled their own pocket of the world's wars, famine, and suffering. Rohingya and South Sudanese, Kachins and Pakistanis. Just as Fu had made it out of Vietnam, and hundreds of thousands of refugees had escaped Laos at the end of that war, some of these kids were making the journey to America. For the last few days, each time Obama had a media availability, there was a mini-intervention beforehand as people tried to help him find the right tone on ISIL. Show more anger. Speak to people's fears. As a mother, Susan Rice told him in one of these sessions, I can see why people are afraid. You have to meet them where they are. I get that. But more people die slipping in the bathtub than from terrorist attacks, Obama said. But folks back home think that ISIL is going to come behead them, Susan said. That's because there's a bunch of folks on television telling them that, Obama shot back. I'm trying not to do that. Obama made his way around the room, asking the children what they wanted to be when they grew up. An engineer, one said. An artist, said another. He knelt for some time next to a Rohingya girl with a white headscarf. She was painting something, smiling shyly while averting her eyes. I stood against the wall, looking at the different kids, most of whom had been rescued from human traffickers. When we were done, Obama took a few pictures with the kids, and then made his way to an adjacent room. That's who we need to keep out of the country, he said to me, mimicking his Republican critics with a sharp edge in his voice. That little girl with a headscarf. We flew to Paris a couple of weeks after the terrorist attack to join the world in pursuing a global accord to combat climate change. Republicans disparaged the effort. Reporters asked us what we thought was the bigger threat, ISIL or climate change. It was a trap. Of course, climate change is a bigger threat. Now that I had a young daughter, I shuddered to think of a world ravaged by conflict and disruption that awaited her if we failed to take the threat half as seriously as terrorism, which we'd spent trillions of dollars fighting. But if we said that out loud, we'd only fuel another controversy. One more thing for Donald Trump to attack. A couple more days of oxygen for cable news debates. Think about it, Obama said to us on the flight over. The Republican Party is the only major party in the world that doesn't even acknowledge that climate change is happening. He was leaning over the seats where Susan and I sat. We chuckled. Even the National Front believes in climate change, I said, referring to the far-right party in France. No, think about it, he said. That's where it all began. Once you convince yourself that something like that isn't true, then... His voice trailed off, and he walked out of the room. For 6 years, Obama had been working to build what would become the Paris Agreement, piece by piece. Because Congress wouldn't act, he had to promote clean energy and regulate fuel efficiency and emissions through executive action. With dozens of other nations, he made climate change an issue in our bilateral relationship, helping design their commitments. At international conferences, U.S. diplomats filled in the details of a framework. Since the breakthrough with China and throughout 2015, things had been falling into place. When we got to Paris, the main holdout was India. We were scheduled to meet with India's Prime Minister, Narendra Modi. Obama and a group of us waited outside the meeting room when the Indian delegation showed up in advance of Modi. By all accounts, the Indian negotiators had been the most difficult. Obama asked to talk to them, and for the next 20 minutes, he stood in a hallway having an animated argument with two Indian men. I stood off to the side, glancing at my BlackBerry, while he went on about solar power. One guy from our climate team came over to me. "I can't believe he's doing this," he whispered. "These guys are impossible." "Are you kidding?" I said. "It's an argument about science. He loves this." Modi came around the corner with a look of concern on his face, wondering what his negotiators were arguing with Obama about. We moved into the meeting room, and a dynamic became clear. Modi's team, which represented the institutional perspective of the Indian government, did not want to do what is necessary to reach an agreement. Modi, who had ambitions to be a transformative leader of India and a person of global stature, was torn. This is one reason why we had done the deal with China. If India was alone, it was going to be hard for Modi to stay out. For nearly an hour, Modi kept underscoring the fact that he had 300 million people with no electricity, and coal was the cheapest way to grow the Indian economy. He cared about the environment, but he had to worry about a lot of people mired in poverty. Obama went through the arguments about a solar initiative we were building, the market shifts that will lower the price of clean energy. But he still hadn't addressed a lingering sense of unfairness, the fact that nations like the United States had developed with coal and were now demanding that India avoid doing the same thing. "Look," Obama finally said, "I get that it's unfair. I'm African American." Modi smiled knowingly and looked down at his hands. He looked genuinely pained. "I know what it's like to be in a system that's unfair," he went on. "I know what it's like to start behind and to be asked to do more, to act like the injustice didn't happen. But I can't let that shape my choices, and neither should you." I'd never heard him talk to another leader in quite that way. Modi seemed to appreciate it. He looked up and nodded. Chapter 28. Havana. As we headed into the final year of the Obama presidency, we inhabited two distinct worlds. In one, we'd achieved a global climate change agreement, the Iran deal was being implemented, the economy was growing, 20 million people had signed up for health care, and Obama's approval rating was rising. In another, Republican presidential candidates were painting a picture of a dystopian nightmare of crime, rampant immigration, ISIL terrorism, and wage stagnation in America. Because the two realities were so far removed from each other, and because Obama wasn't running, it was hard to do anything but put our heads down and focus on what we could get done. My issue of focus continued to be Cuba and, increasingly, the trip Obama would make to Havana in 2016, the first for a U.S. president since Calvin Coolidge. Over the last year, I'd learned that my work in Cuba was far from done. We wanted to push as far as we could to open a door for American travel and business and promote reform in Cuba. The Cubans wanted to make as much progress as possible to build a bilateral relationship during the last 2 years Obama was in office. I assured them that any Democrat who succeeded Obama would continue our approach, but I couldn't say the same about a Republican. The Cubans understood this. Each time I'd go, I stayed at a guest house that seemed transported from the 1970s, with white floors, modernist furniture that went out of style so long ago that it'd be trendy in Brooklyn, and long balconies from which I could see security guys dressed in guayaberas. Fidel, I was told, had convened an all-night meeting at the building next door, where he had made a pivotal decision about a military operation in Africa. Cuba, it seemed to me, was a layered society, an inner core that grasped onto its revolutionary legitimacy, the old stories of Fidel, and a broader outer ring comprising millions of people whose opportunities were embalmed by politics, a government focused on sustaining its own power U.S. policies that walled them off from the wider world. We were trying to breathe new life into Cuba by opening things up. My first night in Havana, we piled into a van to tour the city. We stopped to get out in Old Havana, a small enclave of Europe in the Americas, 19th-century facades and cobblestone squares, a place frozen in time by the absence of American engagement, like a ruin preserved deep underground. We passed the National Assembly, a smaller replica of the U.S. Capitol. Old American cars filled the streets. We were shown a spot where Batista's troops surrendered to Che Guevara's unit during the revolution. Nearby, Ricardo mentioned to me under his breath, was a spot where firing squads had purged political opponents. We stopped at a statue of Christ, something sponsored, I was told, by Batista's wife in the final days before the revolution. I stood at the base of it until I noticed what appeared to be a few tourists nearby. Not unlike the people who had photographed Ricardo and me in the lobby of a hotel in Toronto, they approached us conspicuously. They spoke accented English at first, and then switched to Russian, speaking loud enough to ensure we could hear. None of us acknowledged it. I thought again about what kind of message the Russians were trying to send. In 2017, months after leaving government, I learned that some Americans at our embassy were harmed in mysterious attacks, from a sonic weapon or some kind of toxin. I knew that the Cuban government had never done something that brazen, even at the height of conflict with the United States. Whoever harmed those Americans clearly wanted to sabotage the opening between our countries, and I wondered whether the Russians who took such an apparent interest in my efforts had played a role. Late that night, we arrived at an enormous parade ground. On the large concrete building in front of me, there was a huge illuminated image of Che over the slogan, Hasta la Victoria siempre, the same image that adorns the walls of thousands of college dorm rooms across America. We stood at the base of a soaring statue of José Martí, the independence hero of Cuba, who is claimed by both Cubans and Cuban Americans. This, I was told, is where Fidel gave his speeches. I looked out at the vast, empty expanse in front of me. If you closed your eyes, you could see the crowds that would stand there for hours and hours, extras in an endless duel between the Cuban state and its massive neighbor to the north, chanting slogans. The entire night seemed to be, inadvertently, a demonstration of how the United States and Cuba have been locked in an embrace like two exhausted boxers who become tangled up in each other's arms, at odds with each other, yet needing each other as foils. "This is where the heads of state lay wreaths," Alejandro said. Before I could respond, someone appeared at my side holding a wreath. It was now after midnight. I would be photographed by the Cuban government laying a wreath here, in the middle of Cuba's Revolutionary Square. It was not an image that would go down well in Florida or parts of Capitol Hill. To reject it, though, would have been playing the part of the ugly American, pressed into an insult of Cuban dignity. I took the wreath and looked up at Martí, the one figure in Cuba's history revered on both sides of the Florida Straits. "To the memory of José Martí," I said, "who is beloved in both the United States and Cuba." Obama's trip to Havana would be in March, because he wanted it to coincide with Sasha and Malia's spring break. Every detail of the trip, from the policy changes we were both pursuing to supporting the American businesses trying to get into Cuba, to the intricacies of Obama's schedule, was a subject for painstaking negotiation in endless Skype sessions and multiple trips to Havana. At the end of one of our meetings, Alejandro asked to see me alone. They had one dramatic proposal that they wanted me to explore. "We are very interested in Guantanamo," he told me. "We know of President Obama's interest in closing the prison, and so we would propose to take custody of Guantanamo." I started to say, as I had many times, that Obama's priority was closing the prison, that we couldn't even talk about the naval base. He cut in. We take note of your difficulty in removing prisoners. We were still haggling with other countries to take one or two detainees who were cleared for transfer. Cuba is prepared to make the security requirements to hold them. It dawned on me what he was proposing, that Cuba would take all of the prisoners if we gave them back the naval base, a piece of Cuban territory that had been occupied by the United States for more than a century. Each year, the United States gives Cuba a check for a few thousand dollars to pay for the facility. The Cubans never cash it. I just want to be clear here, I said. You are offering to take all of the prisoners? There were, at that time, nearly 100. Cuba is very good at holding people securely, he said. There are some that we'd need to remove, I said, thinking of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the 9/11 mastermind. We'd been prevented from transferring him and others to prisons in the United States because of laws passed by Congress. Teams of lawyers had looked at other possibilities, including holding them in U.S. territories such as Guam or Puerto Rico. Whatever you need to do, he said. For the rest of my time in government, there wasn't a meeting when he didn't revisit this idea. Even as I knew it was unlikely to happen, I came to like the idea, and I told Obama so. We could have some negotiated transition period where the United States and Cuba jointly administered the facility. In meeting after meeting on Gitmo, I'd hold up my hand and say, I'm the only one with a plan B. Obama dismissed it as a bridge too far, even for the fourth quarter. But I couldn't help but see the unintentional genius in the idea. Righting two historical wrongs, ending two chapters at once. During one lengthy dinner in Havana, a few days before Obama was scheduled to arrive, Alejandro abruptly left the table to take a phone call. When he returned, he announced that he and I would now go to visit the president. He never once referred to him as his father. We left abruptly, piling into the back of a black BMW for the short drive to a large government building. A few plainclothes security guys stood in the lobby as I was ushered into an underfurnished room where Raul was sitting wearing a guayabera. We sat down, Oval Office style, with me in a chair adjacent to Raul. Raul did most of the talking. A few minutes into the meeting, he took out a fold-out map of Cuba and made me hold one end of it as we leaned over like two generals assessing a campaign. He began by tracing the progress of the revolution from the Sierra Maestra Mountains to Havana. He showed me various military airstrips that could be turned into civilian airports and described their proximity to beaches and other attractive sites. Pointing to Cuba's perimeter, he welcomed the Paris Agreement, talking about the risk of climate change to Cuba's outer ring of islands and keys. In his own way, he was showing me the outlines of a tourist economy that Cuba was building, an economy that depended upon an eclectic mix of state-run hotels and individually owned small businesses such as restaurants, shops, and taxis. He pointed to a tiny speck of land south of Cuba. There, I have allowed an Italian businessman to park a houseboat with five beds where he feeds sharks all day. I nodded, not sure what to make of this anecdote. Caroline Kennedy was in my office the other day, I said. She noted that it wasn't her father who had closed the embassy, that he'd inherited Eisenhower's Cuba policy. Castro nodded. Robert Kennedy's son recently came to Cuba, he said, and even though his father tried to kill my brother, I let him stay on these beaches. I even let him stay with the Italian who feeds the sharks. Somehow, this anecdote seemed to reveal something essential about Cuba. He returned again and again to the revolution, to the stories of how poorly the landing of the Granma had gone, and of how he and Fidel greeted each other. I had five rifles, he said. When we came together, he grabbed me and put his forehead to mine and said, How many rifles do you have? I said, five. He said, I have two. Raul sat back and slapped his knees. That makes seven rifles, so we will have to take them from the enemy. And that is what we did. I also knew that this talk of the revolution wasn't just posturing. It was intended to show that he wasn't going to compromise the revolution's legitimacy. The talk of the evolving economy was intended to show that there was a streak of pragmatism to